Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.
9 minutes after 9 o'clock, it's Crispin Peary, who is my guest this evening, and this is his selection, Calvin Momo. Good evening and welcome, Crispin.
Good evening. Thank you for having
me. Come closer to the mic. We can hear you now. Welcome to Point of View.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure.
It's all about you today. We're not asking any official questions.
There are a lot of tough questions out there. So.
We're not asking any official questions. This is all about you. Let's start by talking about your song, Mkuzeni.
Yeah, I think what I like about it is actually also the genre, but it's one of Calvin Momo's new songs on his new album, Tato Yamudimo. Mm-hmm. But what I like about it is amapiano is sort of our generation's contribution to the music genre. Yeah. We've come from the Brenda Fassies, the Lucky Dubes, the Kwaito era, and I think this is how young people of our era are expressing themselves musically. So,
What does music mean to you?
A lot of things. You'll hear what you're hearing today is probably what's on my playlist any given time. But music is a lot of things. It gets me through the day. It inspires me. It picks me up when I'm down, or it's celebration, sets the scene, calms me down. So yeah, music means a lot to me, and I quite enjoy music. I listen to music in different ways as well. Sometimes I don't know the lyrics, but I definitely know the beat of a song. That's how I listen to music. But I really do enjoy good music.
Yeah. You know, you just spoke about what I imagine to be a very busy day sometimes.
Yes.
These long, very long days. What really, when you go through these days, when you reflect about the kind of days that you have, what gives you a sense of hope?
I think the desire of the world that we want to see. The people that you meet as well does give one a sense of hope. But I think just the commitment of this is what we are trying to achieve, or this is who I stand for, this is my contribution today to society, and we can get to do it again tomorrow, or we didn't win today, but there's another opportunity tomorrow. It's many things that give one a sense of hope, but there are also days where you feel maybe it's a lost cause. We should just focus on one individually and leave societal aspirations. Because in my role, I think a lot of the work that we do is most of the time around societal aspirations. Yeah. And there are times where you think maybe I should just focus on 5 to 9, and that's where my day ends.
What took you to politics?
It's an interesting question. I've always observed politics from afar and close by, and I think my first weird exposure to politics was when I was 3 or 4, when Chris Hani had passed on, and we lived in a suburb adjacent to where Chris Hani lived, Don Park. So he lived in Don Park, then we lived in Leondale. Mm. And on the day of his funeral, I saw streams and streams of buses. Driving from the house or driving towards the stadium. When we were in Leondale, they were driving, I think, to Soweto at the time, and I had this conversation with my mom, what's going on? And she said, oh no, that's comrades are going to Chris Hani's funeral. And that sense of injustice has lived with me forever, and trying to correct an injustice and trying to understand how we can be better off together rather than divided, or generally dealing with injustice. So even my vocation, law, originally, was around dealing with injustices. And so in that process, when one got exposed to politics from varsity, I was also involved in the SRC and the South African Students Congress at the time there, and dealing with real, tangible political issues. Because, you'll have a student coming from the Eastern Cape. You don't have money to study, but you're here. I've got the marks. How do we solve for this problem? That's an injustice that you are confronted with. And from then on, I've just always been involved in politics, trying to resolve injustices. I guess that's the best way I can frame it.
You have a slightly interesting background in the sense that you were obviously involved in student affairs, so you do have a sense of the reality of what it is that real people have been confronted with. But entering government must have been interesting.
Yes. Well, my first job was at the Competition Commission. Mm. So that's where I entered government. And it was a fascinating job, and I still think one of the best, because also there you're dealing with the structure of the economy. Mm-hmm. And I studied competition law at school, but I then realized that I think competition law is a branch of law that I really want to specialize in, as I thought at the time. And entering government from that lens was a great, great eye-opener. When we speak about an uncompetitive economy, this is the reality of it, you know. I've heard someone say this before, but I then got to see it at the Competition Commission, that South Africa is a country where you only have four of everything.
Mm.
Think of petrol stations, you probably have four. Where you buy our clothes, probably. So it's a highly concentrated economy, and that's what we have to solve for. So that was my first entry into government. Then I went into the private sector to try and do my articles. I then decided, actually, I don't want to be an attorney. And I went into the Department of Communications, government communications at the time, with Deputy Minister Thandi Mahambihlala, whom I knew from my student activist days. And then you then get to see government at a different level, almost at the level of the executive.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize that serving and having to be everything to everyone is a very, very difficult job. Government is very, very hard.
It is hard. What surprised you the most about your experience in government when you got in?
I think the scale of complexity.
Yeah.
You're constantly dealing with multiple interests, and everything is important all the time. In every government department that I've been, everything is very important, whether it's SABC being well-funded or whether it's community media functioning at a level that we think is acceptable. All of these things matter and are of varying interests to everybody, but there's very little to go around in terms of time for that, or even government money across the board. You see it now in DIRCO as well. Every country's relationship is important.
Yeah.
And you have to treat them with the same level of respect. But of course, in the geopolitical space, there are many moving parts, so you might find your attention focused on one part, but then it looks like you are sort of neglecting another. Striking that balance is incredibly difficult in government. But the scale of complexity is something that I think you can only wrap your mind around once you're actually in government.
You have the privilege of experiencing the world through the lens of someone who's got some level of proximity to power. And I wondered what your perspective of the state of the world right now is, having that proximity.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think the world is undergoing seismic shifts in what it has been oriented, how we have sought to orientate ourselves around the world. So maybe when in the 1990s, that was the Cold War era, we tried to break that and go for globalization. But now we are seeing a rejection sort of globalization. We are also seeing people receding a bit on the idea of liberalism. And so that's, you see this very narrow focus on nationalist interests. And you see that all across the world, even with us, I think, as South Africans, we don't read much into it, but it's happening. I mean, when you see people stopping people from getting healthcare at a clinic, and you understand how people have sort of arrived at the point where they're saying, but you know, how this is not sustainable. But you can see that people are now rejecting liberalism in its widest sense, the idea that human rights are for everybody. People are now looking at, no, let's look at our border first, and then we can think about our neighbor next. But you also see it in the everyday context. I think the idea of Ubuntu is a very, very lofty ideal. It wasn't always the case. I think it was a way of life, especially for us Africans. But it's not uncommon to hear someone saying they don't even know who their neighbor is, you know, in the context in which we live in, and how we live, and how we've organized our societies today. So I think the world is going through this shift where we're becoming more narrow, and strangely enough, very individualistic as countries in our focus.
You know, being a young person in politics and obviously in a political movement, I'm curious how, as a young person, your experience of being a committed, I'll call you activist, so to speak, in a movement that you hear every single day bashing of the character, the value system of the movement. How does that land with someone as young as yourself?
It is a struggle, I will be honest, because there are things that you look at and you're like, surely this is not justifiable. But there's also an understanding, and a very deep understanding in me, that this organization stood for what we want to see in society. And I mean, today we were celebrating the Freedom Charter, for example. And there's this juxtaposition as where you look at Clip Town as it is now, and you look at the document that was there, you can't reconcile the two. There are those contradictions, but I think the commitment to who we ought to be and who we want to be is something that drives me deeply. And I think every organization goes through an evolution of sorts. Even a devolution goes backwards, quite
absolutely,
frankly.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think we are in that moment where we need to decide how we evolve, because governing, being a democratic organization and being an organization that was a liberation movement requires very, very different skill sets. And
absolutely,
I think we've never had that conversation deeply enough and in a realistic way. We're still trying to go about things as if it's President Nkrumah is still the president. Like the model, literally the model that the ANC operates on is a 1944 model that was designed by President Nkrumah. So this is something that I believe we should start thinking about deeply. I think our organization requires a new organizational redesign. We need to rethink how we go about prosecuting its ethos in a democratic society. So
let me take a quick break. When I come back, I'm very happy to take your calls, your questions, your comments. If you want to chat to Crispin, you're very welcome to do that. 086-000-0959. You can also send voice note on
063-688-0959. On Kaya 959
with Pimela Mudime.
What's yours?
What's yours?
We continue our conversation with Crispin Peary. He's my guest this evening. And as we play his playlist, John Mayer is interesting, believe. Talk to me about that.
It's one of my favorite songs, because I think it really explains the state of the world. If you look at why we live, we have a certain belief. If you look at why certain conflicts exist, they're also driven by certain beliefs. So I think my favorite line in the song is belief is a beautiful armor, but it's also the heaviest sword.
That's true.
And I think it's really a profound song. But John Mayer is an amazing guitarist as well. So he's really one of my favorite artists. If I could play an instrument, it would definitely be a guitar.
You know, everybody's been talking about the national dialogue. For you, what would you think should be prioritized in the dialogue by the nation?
I think who we want to be in the world. So let's imagine South Africa didn't exist. What would the world lose by South Africa not existing? I think that's something that we need to be very clear about, as patriots, as citizens, that this is our contribution to the world, but also how we want to coexist. I think I'm constantly disappointed by seeing how there's apartheid nostalgia in society.
Yes.
At various levels.
Yes.
And you ask yourself, I mean, you know, if you understand what apartheid has done to our psyche, let alone our lived experience, it's not something that we should ever be nostalgic about. And I think that's something that we really need to get out of our system in our thinking. But also,
what do you think causes that?
So I think there are various elements to it. If you look at how generationally our society is structured, my mother's born in the 1960s. I mustn't reveal her age. But she would be the generation that experienced Bantu education. And in the main, they would be that generation are your teachers in society and your nurses. They experienced the full force of apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
And amongst, and I can say this on this station because it's a progressive black station, I think a lot of people still in that era view whiteness in a particular
mm-hmm.
way. And so even now, mm-hmm. we are socialized around whiteness almost being better.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that willingness to see yourself through a white lens.
Mm-hmm.
So we've not been
and
able
to... And aspire to the proximity as well.
Yes, and so that's, I always say, that's also why if you... But you... Your definition of success is living, mm-hmm. living where the white people live. It's not, how do I turn Morris Isaacson into the next St. Stithians? No, mm-hmm. your preoccupation is, no, why, my kids went there or I went there and we shouldn't go there. My kids should go to a white school. So that also is something that I think in our national dialogue we need to be able to have a conversation about, is how do we integrate, truly integrate as South Africans? Mm-hmm. How do we get rid of the legacies of apartheid, both socially and psychologically as well?
So what preoccupies young people's minds, your generation?
Yeah, that's a very good question. and I've been thinking about it, interestingly, in like the past couple of weeks, like what are we preoccupied with? Because you look at the national discourse amongst young people, I think a lot can improve around that. But I think it's a question of us owning our space. I think that's what young people, at least ambitious young people and people who aspire for a better society, it's a question of how do we now own the space and define it.
Mm.
But I also have a view that being young in and of itself is not good enough.
Mm.
You have to really think about society in a meaningful way. Mm. And I think sometimes our preoccupation is, where are the young people in the room?
Mm.
Instead of, how do I ensure that I'm impactful where I am?
Mm.
What type of activism do we produce as young mm-hmm. people? So like we were saying with the organization that I belong to, the African National Congress, mm. we could be reimagining how the organization is. But I think some of the preoccupations is almost bean counting. Are there five young people?
Yeah.
Are they okay? And then how do I make sure I'm the one of the five?
Mm.
Instead of, let's reimagine this thing. It's irrelevant in this current form. This is how young people engage with politics now.
Mm.
This is how society deals with this, views this, which was previously taboo, for instance. You know, how do we conceptualize the politics around that? So, yeah, I think that should be the preoccupation of young people. I'm not sure if it is. I think materialism is also something that you see, crass materialism at that, might I add,
mm-hmm.
Being very, very prevalent, instant gratification.
Mm-hmm.
I was having a conversation with a cousin of mine a couple of days ago, and we were trying to figure out, when did we get to a point where you can go on TikTok and show every aspect of your life? But it's that thing that instant gratification gives you, almost even glorifying what we call poverty porn, you know, where you glorify that I live here and this is how I live. That fine line between reality and showing reality, but also being aspirational about how you want to be seen and what you want to do in the world. So I think a lot of things are preoccupying young people, but materialism, I think, is really eating away at how we conceptualize ourselves.
Do you have a sense of how we got here, in that sense?
Sure. I thought there were no tough questions today. Yeah, I think in many ways, like the conversation that we were having earlier before we got on, how we are socialized is contributes in a big way. So you switch on the television and you are confronted with it. Crass materialism, deep, deep westernization in what you watch on TV, the type of music we listen to in many ways. And we are not able to differentiate between that being not reality and it being aspirational.
Mm-hmm.
On the other end, you also see it in the type of programming that you see generally on TV. I was saying, like, you hardly ever see anymore a TV show that has black people being very, very successful CEOs. Now, the major program is Yuachola 99 or I don't know. There's a lot of shows out there that you ask yourself, what does this show really do for society? Mm-hmm. And like we're saying, there's a fine line between holding up a mirror to society, but there's also, I think, a collective responsibility for us to say, how do we conceptualize society the way we want to see it, and how do we contribute towards it? And one of the ways this triggers this point is, I don't know how we've lost our humanity. I mean, the fact that a site like Cliptown is desecrated, it's by us. It's not necessarily government that went there and smashed the place apart, but it's a very important monument that should mean a lot to everybody. It's a site, a historical site. And I think we may have lost that ability to say, we are all collectively responsible for X.
With what you've just cited, it's certainly not a South African problem. I mean, that's prevalent in many parts of the world, materialism and all of that. I want to know what your sense of where the continent is headed, perhaps in 3 decades' time. What's your sense of that?
The continent is a fascinating place. And one of the things that is most hurtful about the continent is, if you want to see the continent's most talented people, you won't find them on the continent. You'll find them in Western nations. Yeah. I mean, we've just seen now the mayor candidate of New York is actually a Ugandan person in the true sense, Professor Mahmoud Mandani's son. Those are people that should be on our continent. Yeah. So that's the first thing that's a bit scary about the continent, but it's also one of the youngest, it's definitely the youngest in the world. And I heard a fascinating statistic that over the next, I think, 10 years, one in every 10 person that is born will be born on the African continent. Yeah. That also tells you that our population is growing. The potential of our African continent is out of this world. But our preoccupation as young people on the continent seems not to be redefining what the continent should be.
What's holding the continent back?
I think simplistically, one can say it's the elders, it's the politics of the continent. But there are really harsh realities that if you look at the socioeconomic conditions of most African countries, and I don't know how South Africa gets this right, because we're not that far different in terms of inequality. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It may be some of our social policies that have really bridged the gap. It's all you're focused on survival as a young person. If you get a good education, a good quality education, and you get to university, you're one of the very few. And so that really holds us back, I think. Access to very basic things that make societies function on the African continent is something that needs to improve. And there's also an interesting stat that 600 million people on our continent don't have basic electricity, just simple electricity. We take that for granted as one of Africa's most industrialized countries. But those are very survival things that make your life infinitely better. I mean, you can then start focusing on your own development as a person. At least you've got the basics in place. And I think that is what's holding us back. So it is a function of, I think, to some extent, political direction, because, of course, these are the basic necessities that every society should have. But as a young person in country X, if you are only focusing on I need to get through to the next day, then that becomes your life.
You know, I was thinking earlier on about the quality of leadership that the world is experiencing right now, and you almost look at every corner of the world, and I struggle to find model leaders, so to speak. And it's one thing to feel that way as just an ordinary citizen, but you probably have even more exposure to what we don't get to see. So what's your sense about the quality of leadership that is currently running the world and it is emerging? Are you hopeful about perhaps the leadership that's going to emerge after what we're experiencing right now, this particular era?
Sure. Fascinating question again. I think there are immensely talented people in our generation and of our era, but the world is also a very different place. We're incredibly interconnected, and we cannot undo it anymore. And so I think the next group of leaders appreciate that. And if you look at what the global discussions are, it's about how do we ensure that no one gets left behind? How do we ensure that the sustainable development goals get implemented? So we are having conversations a lot more around cooperation, even with the type of world leaders that we have now. But like I say, many of them, like our parents, are of a particular generation. So they would have a Cold War lens on the world. This is West, this is East, we are traditional enemies. Whereas our generation looks at the world a lot more differently. It's true. You wouldn't look at East and West. It's a question of, well, how do we collaborate to ensure that we mutually benefit? So I think there is that sense, that language is there. It will be our generation that really brings it to fruition in the realist sense.
From a personal perspective, do you think you've got the stamina? It's a long marathon, right? Is this something that you foresee yourself doing? Are you committing your life to service?
Yeah, it's difficult to imagine my life without service. It is really difficult. And I'm constantly thinking of ways to even improve my activism. How does it become a lot more impactful? How does it become more citizen engaging, directly one-on-one? And maybe not even with the cover of a political banner, but just generally as a person. That I think is my calling, in a sense. How do I leave the next person better off? How do I ensure that there's society is not the way I found it? I think that's something that lies in me profoundly. So it's difficult to imagine my life without service.
Let's take a quick break. We'll be back with more after this.
On Kaya 959
with Pimela Mudine.
What's yours?
So there's no need to introduce Miriam Makeba.
Absolutely not.
Let's talk about your connection to Miriam Makeba.
She's an activist.
Yeah.
Very fascinating South African, multilingual in a couple of languages of the world.
Yeah.
I think, in a sense, she was one of our best diplomats, cultural diplomats, and just generally a very good advocate for anti-apartheid South Africa.
Yeah.
And this song also speaks to that.
Yeah.
Her ability to match activism with what she does with her talents was amazing. So great love for Miriam Makeba, and she's Mama Africa, truly.
I often think of why and how the world got exposed to Miriam Makeba, and absolutely through the ANC. That intentional move by Tambo to say we've got to use the arts as a vehicle and as a tool to get the world on our side. And she obviously was one of the products of that. When did that link between the arts and politics kind of fade away in the African National Congress?
Oh, I can't put my finger on it. I don't think it faded away per se. I think if you look at even the cultural sphere that we're in currently, you, except for Amapiano now recently, you do hear songs that are very socio-economic in their orientation. But there was a moment where our songs were, I don't know, I don't want to insult anyone, but they were, but reflective of the times that we're in. It's no longer liberation struggle. It's status quo. It's fun times. That was a reflection of that. But even there, you have artists like Tandiswa who are able to comment critically on society. So I think naturally, even as we become the party that governs, we will also become the subject of criticism from the arts sector, which is a responsibility I think the arts sector holds in society, to also hold up that mirror, both politically and socially, say this is how we express ourselves as a nation. So I don't know if it's lost, but I hear you that it's also not as intentional anymore.
Your musical tastes, Who and what influences that?
My politics influences that. My father also had an influence on my musical taste. So I grew up listening to 5 FM, to Jacaranda, to Kaya FM, to Metro, all these various stations. I, at some point, really was immersed in them. But just exploring, someone who just randomly listens to anything sometimes just to hear what does this sound like. There's a strange band that I found called Karumbin.
Yes.
They're also quite interesting. It's a US band that sounds like Afghani type of music, and they've and Turkish music and psychedelic sounds. Fascinating. My brother as well. My brother was a musician, a drummer. And so, like, I think I got a lot of the jazz influence from him. And he got trained by jazz legends like Johnny Mekwa the late and Jonas Ngwangwa at the time at the Gauteng Music Academy. So I think a lot of my jazz influence I get from my brother. But also gospel music. We go to church and we sing a lot. And so that also has an influence on one's musical outlook.
You're still very spiritual in that sense?
I do pray. I do find time to go to church if I can. Or have a conversation with my pastor every now and then. But yeah, I'm a believer in God.
How important is that for you personally, that connection?
It's my it grounds me spiritually. It's almost a supernatural understanding of the world. Sometimes I think it's difficult to understand things just in black and white. Sometimes there's a different explanation for how things... There's some things that you just cannot explain. And I think really the idea of God or a supernatural power in the sense of a super being does help one explain some things that may seem completely irrational. So I'm a believer in that sense.
We're going to play out with the song Sunday Service Choir. Let's talk about your selection for that particular song and why.
The song always lifts me up, and it's just like a testimonial of being grateful for what we have and giving praise to God for just the happenings of life sometimes, because there are some things that, like I say, you cannot explain with the naked eye, and that's where I feel you give praise to God, and we praise and we sing and we glorify the name of God. And that song always lifts me up when I'm down. It lifts me up when I'm happy. It lifts me up. It's my go-to song a lot.
Would you consider yourself a happy person?
Definitely. I'm a happy person, an optimistic person, maybe sometimes too optimistic. But yeah, I would say I try my best to be happy, not take things too personally. But I'm human. But yeah, I look at things, I'm like, no, I'm not going to take that personally. I'll deal with it and not hold grudges and live life to your fullest.
Can you believe we've run out of time?
Unfortunately.
And we're so grateful. Thank you for
taking time out
and for coming to shed a little bit of light.
That's a great pleasure.
Into who you are and opening up and so being so gracious about it. Thank you, Crispin. I really appreciate it. That brings us to the end of the show. We do, leave you with the song Sunday Service Choir, Lift Up Your Voices. And we are back on Monday at 8.
Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.